Hi everyone, you're listening to the Blockchain Socialist Podcast, and for today's episode, I have Izzy Meckler. He is the Chief Science Officer at 01 Labs, which is building a product called the Mina Protocol, which is trying to be essentially the lightest blockchain using zero-knowledge proofs. Zero-knowledge proofs is a really interesting technology, and it can be a little bit complicated, but Izzy is an expert in this stuff, so he's going to explain some of these things and also tie in how all of this technology kind of comes in through a political lens and through a political framework. So yeah, I'm really excited to talk to you actually.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So like maybe just to start, I think you have a really interesting background. And so maybe it would be good for those who don't know you, if you can just like give a quick introduction to yourself and how you got into the crypto world, and also maybe a bit about your, I guess, political transformation that happened while you were getting into the crypto world, as I understand it.
So in 2016, I moved to the Bay Area to do a PhD at Berkeley, and I was studying math. And I started taking a lot of classes in cryptography because I'd always also been interested in kind of like computer science or like theoretical computer science. And it seemed really cool. And anyway, I got more into it, and I actually like had an advisor in computer science and was, you know, starting to do cryptography research, writing papers and whatever, like, you know, just being a grad student. But at the same time, my friend Evan Shapiro, who I knew from high school, was out here, and, you know, we'd always kind of like, I don't know, toss like project ideas back and forth, and we sort of started, this was around at this time, like in 2016, there was this like big like block size debate in Bitcoin.
I remember that.
And yeah, so that was kind of, I guess, maybe the impetus for like us starting this project, because I knew about zero knowledge proof ZK SNARKs like from my studies, and I kind of thought, oh, okay, like this, why don't we try and like make a blockchain that, you know, like compresses the blocks, and so there's not the same block size issue, or like there's not the same tension between decentralization and like increasing transaction throughput. And so we started working on what eventually became Mina then. But we started a company called O(1) Labs, which
I totally butchered it then.
Oh no, that's okay, everyone does that. It's really confusing. You know, when we started it,
it's,
we were
math
like
notation.
Oh yeah, like yeah, we were like, oh, the name of the company doesn't really matter, like it's just gonna be the protocol, but like that's not really true. Yeah, it's a nightmare for like forms and everything, you know, putting parentheses.
I thought it was a reference to like binary or something. Like zero.
No, it's O(1) because it's like a constant size blockchain or whatever, and like the ZK SNARKs are small proofs. Right. But anyway, yeah, so things have changed a lot since the initial vision. You know, like there is still, Mina still has this fully succinct kind of like ZK rollup, but as an L1 property, like that's still part of it. But what we're really working on now is adding this kind of like zero knowledge application, ZK app, like programmability layer. And, you know, at O(1) Labs, we're focused on kind of like building the tooling for that specifically. We have a TypeScript DSL called SnarkyJS that, you know, is like a really easy way to write kind of zero knowledge proofs generally, and also for Mina. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so anyway, Evan and I like kind of started this project. We started, you know, getting some interest from investors. I eventually, like, we raised money and I dropped out of grad school and started working on it full time. And yeah, I guess in parallel to that, so that was 2016. So Trump, you know, had just gotten elected. And I think I'm really part of this like same stream of history that like a lot of people who are like, who are now socialists, who are like around my age, millennials or whatever, are also in. So I'm it's kind of like, I don't really have to say that much. Like if you're familiar with that historical trend, I'm just like one particle in that stream, but I can give specifics. So yeah, so like it was 2016, Trump just got elected. I don't know. All my friends were like, oh shit, like we should start caring about politics now. I was aware of Bernie and I was aware of like his 2016 run, and I really liked him because I think, yeah, like healthcare, that seemed great. And, you know, it just seemed kind of good. And he was anti-war and like, you know, that all seemed cool to me. And you know, just like you're kind of young, like you have this kind of anti...
broadly progressive.
Yeah, yeah. And like maybe like kind of like anti-establishment, contrarian kind of, I don't know. I feel like that was in the mix as well. Anyway, I was kind of like, you know, around DSA for a couple of years, but got involved DSA is a socialist organization in America called Democratic Socialists of America. It's kind of interesting. It has this sort of, it's a weird organization historically, but it blew up, you know, around this time because Bernie said like, I'm a democratic socialist. So like, I think like everyone just Googled like, what is democratic socialism? And like,
right.
Just joined the first thing, Google result. So I was sort of around that for a while. I think the first time I really got very involved was with the 2020 Bernie campaign. I was like very involved, like, and this is like in parallel to the company developing. But I was like very involved. Like I, you know, was spending all my free time like canvassing, and like I went to Iowa to like go like.
While like running a company or trying to run a company.
Yeah. And anyway, when that failed, that was kind of a positive. I mean, that was like, I think another important step in my kind of political trajectory. Like I got, you know, I sort of like then had to take a step back. I think like a lot of people was like, oh, like, why did that fail? You know, let me like try and deepen my understanding and analysis. And looking back, like it's fine, but like I was very naive, and it was really just, So anyway,
I think everyone was hopeful at that point.
Yeah.
They wanted to believe in something.
I think so. Yeah. So, but anyway, it's good. You know, you learn. So I started like reading more, and you know, learning kind of. I joined this reading group where we kind of like, you know, read all the sort of classics of kind of. Early 20th century socialism, like Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin and, you know, I don't know, Stalin. And then when that was like, I think just before the George Floyd uprising started happening. And then once those started happening, then yeah, we also started reading kind of more kind of like Black Marxism stuff, which was cool. And then, you know, after that, I read Capital and with David Harvey's lectures, which are really amazing. And,
classic.
You know, and now it's been a couple of years since then. So I've just like read more and more. And now I'm like full blown Marxist.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. I guess I imagine that's got to be like a super, I mean, it's a similar trajectory that I think I kind of had, but I mean, very different circumstances. I wasn't definitely not running a company, but from what I understand, like this process as well of you kind of going through this political journey, I think also informed like some changes that were made also with the company, with O1 Labs, not 01.
Yeah.
So I think you guys run it as a cooperative, from what I understand.
Yeah. So I guess it's kind of, I mean, it's a weird, but maybe not that historically unique position to like be a Marxist and whatever, but also like be in the position of running a company. I mean, you know, Engels also, you know, was like a factory owner or whatever. But I think for me anyway, there's personally a contradiction there in your head. Like, oh, like I believe like communism, but then I'm also a boss, you know, like how do you resolve that contradiction? So we eventually turned O1 Labs into a sort of cooperative. The word cooperative is sort of weird because like there's no real definition of it. Like every kind of quasi, like every like sort of democratically run workplace does things very differently. I think like there's not really a standard set of practices that has evolved yet. But yeah, you know, I wanted to kind of square this contradiction in my mind. and inject a little practice into my day-to-day. So basically what happened was Ovum Labs kind of split in a way. So we sort of reorganized things a little bit where now we have, well, not we, but now there exists this other organization called the Meta Foundation that is kind of analogous to something like the Linux Foundation. You know, it's sort of like a not-for-profit entity that like stewards the development of this open source protocol. And then there's Ovum Labs, which is, you know, just like a Delaware C Corp or whatever, for-profit company, that works on basically ZK tooling. And also, you know, we work as like contractors for Mina, I guess now. And anyway, at that time, like as part of this kind of split, we also decided to reorganize Ovum Labs as a sort of democratically run workplace.
Was it difficult to convince like your, like the CEO and like the others you were working with at that time?
So that was kind of, I think, a convenient part of it. So the former CEO of Ovum Labs, my co-founder, Evan, went to go run Mina Foundation.
Okay.
So there was sort of a vacancy, you know, and so there was this opportunity for us to...
A vacuum of power. Power vacuum.
Yeah,
took advantage.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, we did have to get approval from some of our investors. I think I wasn't involved in a lot of those conversations, but I think that wasn't that actually as difficult as you might think. I think they're kind of like, well, you know, as long as I get my money, whatever you do inside is okay with me. So, so what we did was basically my co-founder and I returned, well, in his case, almost all of our equity to like an employee pool. And so there's kind of two parts of, I guess, the cooperative sort of structure. There's like ownership and governance. So ownership, like most of the equity, the more than 50% of the equity, or maybe all, so somewhere around 50%, I'm not sure exactly the number, of the equity is like in this employee pool. And it gets distributed over time in a kind of roughly equitable, certainly more equitable than like a normal startup way, but like there's some like weighting based on like seniority. You know, if you're like a more senior kind of person, like you'll get slightly more equity. But so that's kind of the ownership side of things. But then there's, I think, the more interesting, they're both important, but then there's also like the governance side of things. So there's two democratic institutions of governance that we have so far. One is the board of the company. So in a usual VC funded startup, the board is like maybe like the founders plus like an investor or something like that. In our company, the board consists of five worker owners who have been elected, one person, one vote, by the other, you know, worker owners or voters in the co-op. Right? And the way that you get qualified to vote is like anyone who's been there for at least a year can vote. I think now there's 22 people who can vote. We have something like 30. There's like 30 something people in the company. I guess 20 something have been there for at least a year. So that's how that looks. And then the board appoints the CEO. Then we have this other institution, which is sort of more democratic. I don't know. Like the board is sort of representational, and that's like fine. But there's this other institution, which is more democratic, which is, we call it our General Assembly. And we run it every 6 months. And basically, anyone in the company can write a proposal for pretty much anything. And we come together, we discuss the proposals that you can present, we debate them, and then we vote on them as a company. Mm-hmm. And I actually, I modeled that General Assembly process on like what we do in my tenants union, Tank.
Nice.
So if you're a tenant in the Bay Area, check out Bay Tank, baytanc.com. If you want to, you know, stick it to your landlord or whatever, but
which I encourage everyone to do. Yeah, so like, I mean, it is really interesting. I mean, I think a lot of people in this like milieu, I think of, I guess, sort of broadly progressive who became socialists, millennials, a lot have like felt similarly. And like, how do I contend with like these contradictions with like, I don't know, working a corporate job or something, and then also believing in socialism or wanting to move beyond capitalism, but like finding that there's very little, it feels like there's very little you can do about it. But it's great that I think that you were able to actually to do something with that. That's very cool.
Yeah, it's sort of a weird position to be in, because like usually like people who just the pressures and like ideological filters that like pick out people who start companies usually filter out people who, you know, will believe in socialism or whatever. So
I imagine you may be like the odd one out at like I don't know, entrepreneur meetups or something like that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
At networking events or tech networking events.
Definitely. yeah, but I guess I do think that software engineers in particular, ones who are working at like in industries where like it's kind of a tight labor market, can do a lot. I think mostly people just use that position to like negotiate, you know, really high salaries for themselves, which is fine. I mean, I get it. But I think because of how few workers there are who like have the skills and knowledge in certain domains, you can do a lot. Like you can set up cooperatives with probably minimal pushback from investors. And I don't know.
I feel like there's kind of like it's a weird thing where I think tech workers in general are kind of, I mean, within like this higher, you know, fucked up hierarchy, are like on the higher end of the worker ladder. But because of that, it's also maybe difficult to also unionize tech workers sometimes, because they feel that they already have a pretty good package.
Yeah, labor aristocracy.
Yeah, whenever like they're probably the most powerful position to sort of make considerable changes if they wanted to.
Because they're also the most bought off.
So maybe moving on to MENA protocol, would you maybe explain a bit what it is? Because I think I've mentioned zero knowledge proofs probably before, but I don't think I've ever had someone like properly explain what zero knowledge proofs and kind of like the power of what they are. So maybe we can start with that, and then how that relates to MENA and blockchains generally, because it's a technology that I think, I mean, like every blockchain I think protocol is like trying to use somehow.
So zero knowledge proofs are a primitive for doing private verifiable computation. So let's kind of break it down with an example. What zero knowledge proofs allow you to do is, let's say you have a computation in mind that's like running a program, right? And let's say I have a program. And I want to run that program and convince you of the result of running that program. Okay. So,
could we give it like what if we give it like a very specific?
Oh, let's be really concrete.
For your tenants union.
Oh yeah, we could do that.
To calculate the likelihood of the success.
Sure. Okay. You're a member of some organization where you're voting on something. Let's just say you're a member of a socialist organization. And you are, I don't want to say distrustful of the leadership of your organization, but you have a healthy skepticism of them. And you're running an election or you're voting on some resolution in your organization. And you want to make sure that the leadership can't put their finger on the scale in this election and bias the result one way or another. So what's going to happen is everyone in the org is going to send their votes to the leadership. Then they're going to tally them up, right? And they're going to say, okay, the resolution passed or it failed. And normally you just have to take their word for it. Like there's no real auditing process. But with zero knowledge proofs, what you could do is they would basically, you'd send them your votes. They would then run the program that tallies up the votes, you know, checks, is each ballot well-formed, and, you know, just adds them all up and gets the result. And they would additionally produce a proof that they ran this program correctly. So they would make a zero-knowledge proof that then they could send to all the members, that the members could just check independently and be convinced that the election was run fairly, that no tampering was done. And there's kind of two cool aspects to this. So there's the verifiability thing, which is if you check this, you're a member, you get this proof from the leadership. If you check it and it passes your verification check, then you know that actually the procedure was run correctly. That's verifiability. And then there's a privacy aspect as well, which is perhaps the leadership was able to see some of the information, like who voted for what, or what was the final vote count, or something like that. Depending on how you set up the zero knowledge proof, none of that information will be revealed. All you'll see is that from the proof is that the election was conducted fairly and the outcome was the resolution passed or whatever. And there's also an important property of the kinds of zero knowledge proofs that we use in practice, which are ZK SNARKs, which is their succinctness, which means they're very easy to check. So and they're small. So regardless of how many ballots were in the original election, regardless of how long it took to run the computation of tallying them all up, the proof that you get is going to be really tiny, so like a couple kilobytes, and it'll be very easy to check. You'll be able to check it in a matter of milliseconds. And that's basically true regardless of the size of the computation.
So you can say, from what I understand, and feel free to correct me, you could run like a computation for the results of an election, in which case there may be also like plenty of smaller computations in between that, of like the fact that I voted, you know, a blue, another person voted green. So you can, using a zero knowledge proof, you can ensure that like the leadership doesn't necessarily know what you voted for, as that could, you know, you may want that because the leadership could take advantage of the fact that they know that you voted against them, for example, or whoever wins out. And you can also like prove that, depending on how you set up, you can probably prove like the number of votes for each one, but not necessarily who voted for each one, and therefore also the results of that election, and prove mathematically, very complicated math that we don't want to go into and better for you to read it than to listen to a podcast about it, but can like prove these things in a way that doesn't require certain types of, let's say, centralized trust or single points of failure, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this example is maybe, yeah, a little complicated because in practice, you probably would want to have two layers of zero knowledge proof, as you're kind of suggesting. Like the individual voters, like the members of the org, would probably make a zero knowledge proof that said, I'm allowed to vote, but it doesn't reveal who I am. And like, this is what I vote for.
Right.
Yeah. And then you'll have another proof, which is then like going and checking everyone's ballots, checking, okay, is everyone qualified to vote? And then summing up all the votes and like getting the result.
So you can use zero knowledge proof as like the base layer for like the identity system, I guess, mm-hmm, behind this mm-hmm. voting
yeah.
Membership requirements. Yeah. And then you can use a separate zero knowledge proof system for the tallying of the actual voting.
Exactly. And so that technique of like putting zero knowledge proofs inside proofs is called recursion or proof composition. And so actually that's like kind of what Mina is based on. But also Snarky.js, which is our like TypeScript programming system, is it's the only sort of it's the only existing system that allows you to do recursion very easily. So if you wanted to actually build such a system, I encourage you to Google Snarky.js, go to our GitHub, play around. But yeah, I could give you another example that's maybe, it's a capitalist example, but it's just one that I have in my head that maybe makes things.
You will be canceled after you give this example.
Okay. Oh God. So, okay. So the current process by which, you, let's say, get a credit card from a bank looks kind of like this. You go to their website, then they, you know, they like slurp in all of your personal information from somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. And
like they'll have to do some amount of KYC.
Well, yeah, but they'll also like go to like a credit agency and like be like, oh, tell me like what this guy's other credit cards look like, and tell me like if he has a mortgage, and you know, blah blah blah. And who knows? I mean, they might be getting other shit like, you know, did they go to university, and like, you know, what's their race, and you know, whatever.
All these types of inputs that they put into some algorithm to calculate like a
Exactly. So they take all these inputs, they put into an algorithm, and that spits out like either no or yes, and like have such and such a spending limit, right? That's pretty crappy for, you know, individual people, because there's this whole system by which their personal data is like totally out of their hands and just being like passed around willy-nilly. A better kind of architecture that we would, you know, it's in a capitalist framework. So that's why I could give you utopian examples too, but like, that's like, it's just.
But in this case, I guess like it's, I think what's also about this example is that you could also argue that like people in a shitty situation who may like suffer from like the, you know, systemic issues with poverty, is that they're going to get worse rates on maybe like worse interest rates. They'll get like maybe lower spending limits on their credit cards. They'll get like worse. So like,
well, yeah,
potentially exacerbating.
I wouldn't argue for this as any kind of a system for,
it's not a solution, but it's like
argue. I wouldn't encourage people to put any energy. I would encourage people to put energy only into revolutionary activities and this sort of thing. But let me just finish the example. It's just a good example. Right. So a better way would be if we had a kind of informational architecture where users held onto their own data, or perhaps there was like a third party who held onto the user data encrypted, and then when a user wanted to apply for a credit card, what they would do is they would like basically say, okay, I prove that if you take my data and decrypt it and then run this algorithm, the loan worthiness or the credit worthiness algorithm on my data, the result is X. The result is yes, I deserve a credit card and with such and such a spending limit. And then they would take that, they would produce a proof of that fact, that they are creditworthy, a zero knowledge proof, and they would send that to the bank, and then the bank would just check that instead of having to slurp in all of their data from all over. So, and because it's zero knowledge, like the bank wouldn't learn anything except that they are in fact creditworthy.
I think it's kind of like zero knowledge. I almost want to say like computation, that the when you want to prove something through computation, that's the person who like you are proving this to has zero knowledge about like you.
Yeah, yeah. They will receive zero knowledge except for the output of the computation.
Right. So that might be as a way to what the outcome is for that. But so I think, Mina, I think, takes this idea of zero knowledge proofs and is applying it. I think taking a step further with ZK snarks, which is kind of like this recursive property that you're talking about. Provability, verifiability.
So there's two ways that Mina uses zero knowledge proofs. One is it uses this kind of verifiability and succinctness property to compress the whole history of the blockchain into a tiny little proof. So you know, the normal ways that blockchains work is if you want to verify the chain, you like download the whole history and re-execute it for yourself. What Mina does instead is it's kind of constantly verifying into a proof that procedure of checking the validity of the chain. And every time like there's a new block, it kind of folds it into this proof. So it says, okay, we had a proof that the state before was valid. And when we add one more block to it, it modifies the state to some new state, you know, and then and it sort of wraps that whole thing up into a proof. So it's kind of compressing the chain as it goes along into this one proof. That's what Mina, you know, has done. What we're working on now and what will, you know, is currently running on our Berkeley testnet, and, you know, will be on mainnet relatively soon, is what we call ZK apps, which is basically a smart contract system where the smart contracts are zero-knowledgeified. I don't know how best to put it, but basically each smart contract, you know, if you want to run a smart contract, you actually sort of run it off-chain and produce a proof of its execution and then post that on-chain. And so you can do things privately inside of a smart contract and then kind of sync to the chain to sort of interact between contracts.
So to sort of, I think, maybe try to summarize what you're saying, what is really interesting about Mina Protocol is that it is kind of, it is solving this, the problem of scalability for sure, as far as blockchains go, where in the case of basically every other one, it gets large, it's going to get larger and larger until infinity, because that's how it works. So over time, we will need to have larger and larger amounts of storage. If you want Bitcoin or Ethereum to exist in the way that it does for millennia, we're going to have to store a lot of data. And so Mina kind of solves this problem by using zero knowledge proofs recursively. So taking you're able to keep the blockchain the same size, which is a very small size. I think 20 kilobytes or something like that. A very small size, so that while also being able to give all of the properties that a blockchain has. So it makes it, you basically get around this entire issue of the, you know, infinitely larger blockchain, and therefore also makes it a bit more, it makes it possible to like use to run a node on your phone or something like that on smaller hardware.
Yeah, or at least to verify the current state. So there, yeah, and I'll just kind of emphasize, like, there's really what it's solving is like there's this trade-off between kind of decentralization of verification and throughput or something. And like one way you can solve this trade-off is by just saying, actually, we're not going to have the current state be publicly verifiable or verifiable at all. Like, that's what Solana does. So they just like throw away the history, and like, no, it's just no one ever checks it. So it's just like the current state is the current state because all the validators agreed on it. And there's no way for anyone to like go and audit that per se. The way that Mina works is, yeah, by solving this trade-off by enforcing that as you're kind of going along, you're also producing a proof that anyone can check later.
So what I found interesting as well, from what I understand, based on Ethereum's roadmap from Vitalik, is that this is kind of like the place that also Ethereum wants to get to. But the problem is that, I mean, Ethereum can't get there just like all of a sudden, because there's a bit of technical debt that Ethereum has already built on. And I guess Mina, being a new layer one, can sort of get around all that.
Yeah, so we kind of built it from the ground up for it to be easy to do this with Mina. Yeah, they are kind of trying. Yeah, it seems like they're trying to do a sort of similar thing on Ethereum. Yeah.
And then I think as well, does this setup also improve privacy quite a bit versus using, you know, the ever-present blockchains that exist?
Yeah, so it makes it possible, the new kind of ZK-apps functionality, the new ZK-apps functionality makes it possible to write applications that use user data in a privacy-preserving way. Usually with blockchains, you can't really use private data because everything has to go on chain. With ZK-apps on Mina, you're able to write applications that use user data, but don't reveal that user data. So like, we're working on a system that we call ZK Oracles, which basically allows you to import any kind of Web2 data, any data that you can get over HTTPS into your smart contract. And that opens up a lot of interesting applications, like, you know, only people who have a Gmail account can interact with my application or something like that. And then what you would do is, like, every time you interact with the smart contract, you'd include a ZK Oracle's like proof that I can log into Gmail or whatever, but without revealing what is your email and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Or, I don't know, like, you know, some DeFi thing that you want to prove my bank account balance is at least whatever. And so you could use the Zkig Oracle system to do that in a privacy preserving way where you're not actually revealing anything about your bank account. You're just providing the proof that their balance is at least whatever for you to interact with somehow.
So then I wonder if, like, in a system like Mina, would you be able to have a block explorer?
Yeah. So, I mean, some information, yeah, it wouldn't, I mean, some information wouldn't, there is a block explorer for Mina. So, but I guess it depends on what the applications look like, but yeah, maybe like not all of the information would be on a block explorer. It depends on the applications, but.
I think what is interesting is that you also have, I mean, the same thing with these other privacy tokens with Monero and Zcash, like they don't have, you can't really like check the state of the blockchain. And I think like whether or not it's a blockchain, it's also debatable. I think most people say it's probably not. So Mina is kind of similar to that. And then, but with the addition of smart contract functionality, which is like, as far as I understand, a pretty difficult problem to solve.
It's a little different. So actually transfers, like payments with Mina, all of those transactions are actually transparent. We don't have privacy implemented like on the level of payments. It exists internal to each smart contract. So basically like your smart contract calls, like the data that you feed into the contract is private. But then payments in the Mina token, like will not be private, and people are implementing like private tokens as a smart contract, on top of Mina, but, in the Mina token itself, it's
not by default,
just to clarify. Yeah.
Cool. So like this from a perspective of a crypto bro, Web3 maxi, you know, zero knowledge proofs are like an amazing new primitive that's going to unlock like all this new value, all these new applications that their venture capital friends are going to invest in for them, and, you know, create this kind of like cryptographic utopia. But for you, you know, we've talked about this already a little bit already, but I know you are a member of DSA East Bay, and you've had some thoughts maybe like more concretely on where this type of work that you've been working on around the zero knowledge proofs as being potentially very useful for socialist organizations. So I think one of the examples that we've given is this this voting example, which is applicable to any type of organization. But I think, you know, in especially like DSA, I imagine where it's kind of like a big tent organization where there are people. And you may, you know, there are different factions inside of it, which is like what always happens when political organizations get bigger. Like it's like, I feel like it's healthy to have a little bit of skepticism or doubt or just like desire to want to have like some amount of accountability to like for its leaders and stuff like that. But I was wondering if you had any like other thoughts when it comes to the social implications of something like zero knowledge proofs.
Yeah, sure. I guess like first, I just want to stress that no technology is inherently pushes in one direction. Well, I mean, maybe different technologies do to a different degree push, you know, like if you build like an oil rig or whatever, that's going to have one very concrete effect. But
within the context of, I think like the oil rig exists in the context of like, you know, currently existing capitalism and like the state of climate change. So that does have like a, you know, a politics to it, I guess.
Yeah. And you know, I guess like we have to consider this specific technology of zero knowledge proofs in our specific context. So yeah, I mean, I think, zero knowledge proofs are useful for, enforcing compliance of various kinds. And if you're in the context of an organization where you don't have complete trust in the processes of the organization, it can help strengthen that trust. I think it's useful for that. Although I think there's an important caveat here, which is people need to trust the technology, right? So like if I tried to go in to my DSA chapter and say, hey guys, like I work at this company, and we should all use our product to like improve the functioning of our internal democracy. I don't think that would go over very well. I think people would be like, "What the fuck are you talking about? Like, crypto, bro? Like, you know,
right.
this is garbage. Get out of here." So people would need to believe that the technology really did what it said, and you know, and that's sort of complicated, and I don't really know how you get there, but I think that's just something.
So you haven't yet pushed zero knowledge proofs to DSA East Bay.
No, not yet. But it's funny, we do for voting use this like online voting tool, a few different ones that are totally opaque actually, and like I mean, as far as I know, like I don't, maybe one of them is open source, but one of them is closed source, and
people don't complain about that.
People don't complain about it, but
yeah, I feel like it's just going to be like a really, really big issue to get past that, for just because of the amount of like psychic damage that's been done. I think with social media and cryptocurrencies and sort of like anything that sort of touches it as being kind of a, yeah, de facto right wing scam or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be tough, and there's like always going to be that. And it's just like unfortunate that people don't put the same amount of like scrutiny on, like, I don't know, the fact that your organization is using closed source software also purchased by a centralized profit oriented company to facilitate, you know, various things. But that's sort of the reality. But I imagine, like, I would think that if I had thought about maybe doing this, then you would have to probably start small. Is my guess, is that you would have to like have an experimental, like find some friends that you trust to experiment with it and try to build out from there. That's the only thing that I can think of. And that maybe like goes against some of the Marxist ethos, but within the organization, I think makes sense in order to like build trust through just normal human ways rather than trying to build trust through like the fact that you're using a zero knowledge proof.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So it's about finding those allies. Hey everyone, if you're enjoying this episode so far, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, share with a friend, and join the crypto leftist communities on Discord or Reddit, which you can find links to in the show notes. If you're enjoying the interview or find the content I make important, you can pitch into my efforts starting at $3 a month on patreon.com/theblockchainsocialist to help me out and join the newest patrons like Justin, Boo Inward, Lorepunk, Brady, and Sinclair. Which really helps, since making this stuff isn't free in terms of money or time. As a patron, you'll get a shout out on an episode like I just did, and access to bonus content like Q&A episodes where you can submit and vote on questions you'd like me to answer, and I'll give my thoughts in roughly 20 minutes. You may also get bonus content like what I recently did by releasing the full interview that I had with Vitalik Buterin a week early before anyone else. Of course, I'll still be making free content like this interview to help spread the message that blockchain doesn't need to be used to further entrench capitalist exploitation if we put our efforts into it. So if that message resonates with you, I hope you'll consider helping out. So you have a blog called parametricity.com where I can't remember which piece it was again, but you had listed out a few different use cases that you thought were interesting from a lefting point of view that I thought were really good.
So I think as the intensity of the class struggle hopefully increases over time, resistance from the state, which is pretty low right now because the intensity of class struggle is pretty low, will also increase. And in that context, having some degree of security in terms of like privacy of communications is really important. And also security in terms of the reliability of your systems, right? So like if you're using a voting system that's closed source and runs on some other person's server, I mean, if you're at a scale that the state cares about, it's not very difficult to imagine them intervening to just, you know, change the result of your internal democracy or whatever. You know what I mean? Like change the result of your election. So I think in that context, it would be useful.
I mean, I think we also just see like already a lot of this similar things have already happened in the past. If you take a look with WikiLeaks, with I know various organizers have had like, you know, lost access to their Google Drive. Mm-hmm, because of like one thing or another that they're working on their Google Drive. Like I think it's already an issue, but just not, it's not super visible, I guess. And the the speculative aspects of crypto are very visible. I think that's why you get kind of like, I feel like there's this disconnect.
I think in that sense, so that's like a little bit of a different thing, but yeah, definitely having like non-centralized alternatives to some of these corporate services would be very important.
I mean, I have this, for some reason, a lot of other socialist programmers that I've spoken to largely over the internet about crypto, they insist that decentralization is not important. That actually what's important is just like the fact that workers own the servers or something like that, to that kind of degree.
Decentralization, like in what sense?
Because I guess there are people who are like, who cares if we use a peer-to-peer network? Who cares if we use a federated network? That doesn't matter. Actually, it's better to use a centralized one because then we can take it over and give it to the workers.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess it just depends on the specifics of what the class struggle looks like in any given moment. Like if you're, you know, if you're like...
Are you saying we need to do a materialist analysis of, of a specific context?
Yeah, you got to do a concrete analysis of the concrete situation. Yeah, because, I mean, yeah, if you're in a context of like, okay, this is so far in the future, but, you know, sometimes decades happen in weeks. So, but, you know, if you're in the context of like, I don't know, you're like a guerrilla organization trying to communicate with each other, then you probably don't want to be using, you know, WhatsApp or whatever, where the government can just call, the FBI can just call up Facebook and say, hey, can you just ban these users? You know, you want to be using your own kind of service, and probably not one that's just running on one server, but yeah, some kind of distributed peer-to-peer sort of thing. So yeah, it depends, I guess, on the specifics of what kind of struggle you're doing. But yeah, if you're just like, you know, some workers at Starbucks, like it's probably fine if you use WhatsApp. Like Starbucks is probably not going to coordinate with Facebook to like shut down your
hopefully
your chat. Who knows? I mean, maybe.
Until the class struggle really heightens. No, yeah, I'm just curious your thoughts because sometimes I hear that sometimes, and it was just always strange to me that a lot of these types would just kind of completely ignore brush away entire like classes or types of potential solutions or architectures just because of like, I don't know, just they're kind of like, I feel like they're like imprinting a specific, like a different context in which maybe they're really like into workers taking over the state, and they just like apply that one for one as much as they can, even though it's not the same thing in the context of technology.
Yeah. I mean, in the very long run, you know, in really building a sustainable classless society, you do want to avoid local concentrations of power, because those do, I mean, I think historically tend over time to transform into class structures. Yeah. But that's kind of a long-term consideration. I don't know.
Yeah, of course. So what are your own thoughts on working in the cryptocurrency space while being, you know, such a dedicated comrade? You wrote, perhaps maybe it could be a starting point, you wrote a really interesting piece on your blog, specifically about moralism, which I really liked because it was you wrote about it in a way that like I wish I could write about it.
Okay, yeah, I can summarize that. So there's a certain kind of thinking which is very common amongst left-wing people, which is I think what I would call moralism, which is basically a kind of a certain pattern of thinking and like rhetorical style, which means basing one's opinions primarily in one's own feelings of guilt and belief about how others will judge your moral worthiness or whatever. And we could give a lot of examples of that, but I'm sure people are familiar with. Should we give examples?
Sure. Yeah.
What would be some examples?
I mean the biggest example to me is always cryptocurrency. I think is like kind of people's how they feel about cryptocurrency. I think a lot of the times it comes from like a moralist position.
Yeah, I think and there's certain things about that which are correct, perhaps. But yeah, so it's like people have people have this identification in their mind of like cryptocurrency with financial scams, which is true. I mean, there is a relationship between those two things. But then they generalize it a little bit more and say like, you know, there's a relationship between basically like any kind of cryptography or like just sort of permissionless distributed systems and financial scams. And as a result, yeah, so I feel like that error is a little bit different because then that's really, I think, based on the incorrect identification of like, you know, cryptography and decentralized systems with financial scams.
I mean, I was just thinking like, I don't know, like in a situation where someone could propose like maybe in a realistic, like if you're trying to be a realist about a certain situation, that maybe you have to do something that is like on the edge of like what people deem to be morally correct or not. And while you could prove that it would be a good decision to make or like not, where there is evidence to back it, mm-hmm. but there is this moral component that like that perhaps has more of like a, maybe it derives from like your particular culture, maybe it derives from just like associations being made that make you feel that, well, I could not do that, so therefore or like I associate it with something bad, and therefore like we cannot do that because it is bad.
I see what you're saying. So maybe just to return to what I was saying before, so like this kind of moralistic way of making decisions, basically you ground your decisions primarily in your feelings of what is right and what is wrong, in some abstract sense, what makes you feel guilty, what doesn't. And I mean, I would argue that that's an incorrect way of making decisions, because like that feeling that you have does not capture all of the information about a particular situation or about a particular decision. It is some information. It's this moral signal, which is like a summary of a bunch of information that your brain computes and gives to you. But it's not all of the information about a particular moment. You just have to kind of be more complicated or complex or whatever in your thinking, I guess, take in more information, base your decisions on more information. This is all kind of abstract, but to
make it concrete, I guess, is this like the type of framework that you think about yourself as a socialist in the cryptocurrency world?
I guess it just comes back to like, you know, the concrete analysis of your own concrete situation. So I don't, it's not like my like involvement in my company, I guess, especially now that I'm not like a boss per se. It doesn't really present many material contradictions to like the kind of organizing that I do as a socialist. Yeah, whereas maybe someone would look at it and be like, oh, you're in an industry that is associated with financial scams and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, that's true. But it doesn't, in my concrete situation, there's no like actual, there's not much of a contradiction between like my position in work and the kinds of activities that I would like to pursue.
Right.
As a revolutionary or whatever, you know.
Sure,
what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I imagine that, like, I'm sure you can say that, but to like an outsider's perspective, like judgment could come from a moral position.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, like politically, that may be important, like to, you know, I mean, maybe it is an insurmountable barrier for some, maybe it does make people, you know, completely not trust you or I don't know, whatever. And that's also part of the concrete analysis of the concrete situation that you need to take into account. Do I need to get these people to trust me in such and such a way? Would that require, you know, I don't know, changing my job or whatever? You know what I mean? I don't know.
Right. I mean, it's part of the political complexity, I guess, that you kind of got to embrace, because you can't be, does it make everybody happy? So another thing I want to talk about, actually, because you also wrote another piece that was really good, is about techno-utopianism, especially in Web3, where, I mean, in Web3, like, it's in the crypto space, like, techno-utopianism is for sure, like, all over the place. I mean, if you, like, it is one of the things that, like, really, like, I understand why people get mad, like, when they enter some of these spaces and, like, kind of see the stuff and, like, kind of the things that are said by a lot of the different actors that exist in this world. But yeah, do you want to talk a bit about that?
So I guess I would put it like this. I really like this model of historical materialism, which, you know, okay, for listeners, like there's this thing called historical materialism, that Marxists like to talk about. And it's basically the idea that we live in a physical system. Like, history is a physical system and evolves according to physics. We don't necessarily want to study it on the level of individual particles, because that's too much information. But like, we should still sort of try to think about it like a physical system. You know, a system that has a state and that, you know, moves, and whose trajectory through time evolves via some kind of physical laws. And there's this model, you know, that's all very good, but you need to be specific about what the state of history includes. You're not going to write down the location of every single particle. That's too much. So you need to kind of break it down in some coarser, more approximate way. And one model that I really like of that is this kind of seven coordinates model, or seven moments model. And the idea there is to analyze any historical situation in terms of the following seven coordinates, which are: what is the state of technology? What is the relationship to non-human nature? What are people's mental conceptions of the world? What are the dominant social relations between people? What are the institutions? What are the kind of habits and activities of people's daily life, like driving a car or like drinking coffee or, I don't know, brushing your teeth or whatever? And what do labor and productive processes look like? So that's with seven things. And one of them is technology. So you can think of any historical moment as sort of having these seven coordinates. And sorry, I know this is like a huge preamble, but one of them is technology. One of those seven coordinates is technology. And a lot of technologists are pretty blind to the other six coordinates and really just think about this one, which is technology. And they often think, okay, if I can make an intervention in this one coordinate of technology, then I can totally revolutionize society. I can totally transform society for the better. And you hear that a lot amongst crypto kind of people. I think you would agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this is incorrect. No, that is how. Because.
What? Nothing I was making.
No, we can't. Yeah, no. Actually, you can't. Because.
What?
There's not just. Yeah, sorry. There's not just technology. There's these other six things too.
Shit.
Right. And, you know, any technological change that you make is made in the context of a certain, you know, set of all the other six coordinates, and it will push the kind of technological change that actually gets produced and, you know, promulgated throughout society in a particular direction. And I mean, of course, in capitalism, that direction is towards the accumulation of profit. That's what the whole social order does. It just runs this stupid algorithm of profit accumulation.
Did you describe it as an algorithm?
Yeah, it's an algorithm. Nice. I mean, I'm a computer scientist.
Yeah, I think it's very apt.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I have like this. I've been playing around with this idea of like how there are certain, like I call them like protocols of capitalism, or just like certain things that like, it's just like the properties of capitalism that kind of like very strictly dictate kind of how things progress. But I think algorithm is a similar word to use, I think, for that.
Yeah, I have another blog post about this. But yeah, this is not something that's unique to me. People talk about the process of capital. People often talk about it as a process, like an organism.
But I think like thinking of it sometimes as a... Sometimes I hate when people do it, but I do think sometimes it is useful to think of the world in like a computery framework. Can be helpful in some ways in some frameworks.
Right? It's helpful for me as a computer
person. Sure, yeah, yeah.
You know, like I have another blog post. The title of the blog post is the capitalist class is not the primary enemy. Okay, I don't know.
Spicy. If
I agree with that statement or not, but anyway, yeah, you can kind of, there's like a little image there of like this like self-replicating pattern in Conway's Game of Life.
Yeah.
That like expands and self-replicates. And that's basically what capital is. It's this social process that expands itself by accumulating profit and
social reproduction.
Anyway, on an expanding scale. So anyway, back to techno-utopianism. That's what all efforts, without an effort to challenge capitalism, any action basically taken will be pushed towards a direction of profit accumulation. that's, you know, that's bad. And I mean, I think you can know this just like from a theoretical point of view, like if you believe in Marxism or whatever, but also it's just like, you just, it's very easy to look at history and deduce this as well, which I think most normal people do. You know, they look at, oh yeah, like what about all the utopian promises about the internet that then degenerated into like Facebook and, you know, I don't know, whatever. So I think, most normal people understand this. Technologists, I think it's sort of, you know, necessary to believe that what you're doing is somehow good. Right. Like otherwise you'd feel too bad about it all the time and stop doing it. So it's kind of like a necessary delusion, I think, for people to sustain. It's not correct.
In short, they're wrong.
you can read the article, but yeah, I mean, basically, you know, I mean, it's just, you can look at history. It's happened over and over that technological, any sort of technological developments that maybe have held some utopian promise, like the ability to communicate with any person anywhere in the world, they just get turned into opportunities for profit accumulation and deformed in that direction rather than in any necessarily liberatory direction. We know that the directions of profit accumulation and the directions of liberatory action are not identical to each other. So you know, those two things are different. But I feel like any critique is sort of useless if it doesn't point the way towards a better thing or like a
right. An alternative,
useful modification. Sorry, I'm yeah, some kind of alternative. So like, yeah, you still have these people who like technologists who like want to use, who like want to make technical interventions, technological interventions, and want to, because as I said, like you're a programmer, or whatever. You're going to be a programmer, right? Like you're probably not going to go and, I don't know, do something else. Like you have these skills, you want to use these skills and you want to believe that you're doing something good with them. I think like once you have this kind of anti-capitalist analysis, you can understand that like any intervention in technology is not going to mean anything unless you're also making interventions in the other six coordinates towards like anti-capitalist action, because otherwise your technological intervention is just going to get sort of co-opted in the direction of profit accumulation. People sometimes talk about like class struggle X. I talked about class struggle technologism. I don't know if this really makes sense, but I think it does. Like any real movement towards the abolition of capitalism will have to involve some technological interventions. You know, people need various technologies to build robust, you know, workers' organizations and, you know, in the transition process, like away from capitalism, I mean, there's going to be a lot of technological challenges. But yeah, again, like it depends on what stage in the class struggle you're at or whatever. But yeah, I guess I'm kind of advocating for, what is technologism? It's like, I guess, a belief that focus on technological interventions in terms of these seven coordinates. That's good. Some people need to make technological interventions. I just suggest that those technological interventions be made with the idea of class struggle in mind and to support various other movements in the other six coordinates of struggle.
I think it's about what ends up happening is people build technology with like in a very technical sense, or like within, or the only thing that is outside of the technical aspect of the technology that they're trying to create is basically, can they make money off of this? Can they like fund a startup? Can they get venture capital? Whereas I think if you are anti-capitalist, then you should take, I think there is right now kind of this a little bit of a shift where people are saying, no, technology has like basically fucked us this entire time. Like it's lied on all of its promises. The internet didn't make us any freer. Stop this solutionism, which exists. But if you are trying to have a robust, really like anti-capitalist framework or strategy, then I think it is probably not smart, not a good idea to not consider like the technological aspects, because it's part of this like seven, you know, these seven coordinates, which I liked that you pointed out.
It's one of the seven things that needs to
change. It's not the thing. It is just one of seven, right?
Yeah. And I would just say one more thing, because I think you pointed out really something really important, which is like people's realistic options, or like people, the actual paths by which people make technological interventions are either, yeah, by like starting companies and getting VC funding, which means you will probably be in the profit accumulation direction, or going and working at a company, which also means you're in the profit accumulation direction. So, or like most likely majority of what you're doing. So it's important to emphasize, like, you really need to be part of some kind of organization that is trying to do some kind of anti-capitalist action to do this kind of class struggle, technologism or whatever. Otherwise, as programmer, like sometimes you can do things on your own. Like maybe you can do a work weekend project that overthrows capitalism or whatever. But I gave some examples in the blog, so I'll just enumerate those. So one was, implementing kind of zero knowledge proof based voting systems to support democratic workers organizations to run fair elections. Another example I gave was having like bureaucratic administration of workers organizations. I'm using like distributed systems with some kind of consensus to like reduce reliance on centralized infrastructure providers or like state structures, like legal systems.
But just the amount of like organizations, left-wing organizations that are reliant on Google Drive is pretty obscene. Yeah. It's pretty obscene and like pretty, like I cannot believe that people are like not thinking that this is like a terrible idea in the long run.
Well, on the one hand, I do think it's true about, you know, who said it about the capitalist,
I think it was Lenin.
That you'll use to hang them. I do think that's kind of true. Like I do think some capitalists tend to be sort of short-sighted or in that way. But Google in particular is so integrated with the security state in the US that I'm sure, you know, if they wanted to pull the plug on someone, they would just totally easily do it. But yeah, I mean, it speaks to like what the level of intensity of the class struggle is at the moment.
Sure. I'm not saying that like you're an idiot for using Google Drive if you're just like a bunch of your friends trying to do something, but just like, you know, something to keep in mind in this, I like class struggle technologism, like when in your seven coordinate strategy that you're thinking of for growing your organization, hopefully that you are considering perhaps maybe a roadmap or like a point in which maybe it is time to think about using some other type of infrastructure than relying on Google. But in the beginning, maybe, yeah, they're not going to like stop you from, you know, you and a few friends probably until you get a little bit bigger. But having that just like in mind, you know, just not like completely ignoring it or saying that like, oh, I'm not a technology person, therefore, like, I'm not going to do it. You know, I think that
happens as well. Right. Totally. I'll just finish reading these examples.
Go for it,
because I feel like it points towards like what kind of organizations I might be talking about. So another example would be like encrypted anonymous messaging services for allowing workers to communicate without fear of reprisal from the state or employers. So like that in the context of, I don't know, like a unionization effort or planning a strike or I don't know, whatever. And, you know, but what that means is like if you're trying to work on that, you need to be integrated with a union or, you know, some kind of workers organization.
Do you have thoughts on Signal as like a...
Signal? Yeah, I think, again, like it's all about what level of intensity of struggle we're talking about. Sure. Like at some point, probably they will target you and, you know, get Apple to put a specific backdoor version of Signal on your phone or whatever, because you don't know that the app that's running on your phone is the same as the code in the GitHub repository. But yeah, I think mostly Signal seems good.
Fair. Just wondering.
I wouldn't say anything too spicy on Signal. I would try and do that in person. But And then I guess this is sort of further down the road, but like at some point, in, you know, who knows what the transition to communism will look like in reality that we get, because we're sort of in this period of like decay of the capitalist system. So this final example is like tools, technology that facilitates the local production of necessities of life, like food or whatever. So like that will potentially be, you know, in some context, that would be another like class struggle technologism that you could do. But this is all just a point towards like, you just need to like look at your specific context, look, figure out the actual anti-capitalist struggles that are happening around you and see and try and think if technological interventions like make sense as part of them, I guess.
Right. So build technology within the context that you're in and the overarching strategy that you're trying to pursue.
Right.
Simple stuff, simple stuff. Easier said than done. I hope people listening begin thinking about it now so that they can start building it nearer rather than later.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the problem is that people like kind of start with the technology and then like back into convincing themselves that like it's actually good and, you know, 100% the correct thing to be doing and so on. So
yeah, fair. Well, thank you so much for coming on and teaching us about zero knowledge proofs, about MENA protocol and class struggle technologism. Do you want to leave us some of your handles and the places where people can keep up with you and your work?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter at IZMeckler, so IZMeckler. And then my blog is parametricity.com. And if you look at my Twitter, you can also find like O1 Labs Twitter and MENA and stuff like that.
Nice, yeah. Yeah, I highly suggest people take a peruse through the blog. It is got some very good content on blockchain related stuff and left wing related stuff. I'm not the only one. There are others doing it.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for having me.